ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I've lost my home, all my belongings, and my cat. I've got nothing. Now I've got to start from scratch. You see stories like this happen to other people, but you don't think it's going to happen to you.
One man has been killed and another has lost his home in devastating bushfires across WA. Hot and dry weather has made for challenging conditions for firefighters. We'll head there shortly. And as staff shortages near crisis point, some Queensland schools are going to extraordinary lengths to put teachers in the classroom and keep them there.
We need to make the profession particularly attractive for young people, and if they hear or read the statistics that we know full too well of the volume of hours that teachers are working outside of the workplace, and that's affecting their well-being and work-life balance, which is so important for young people today, it's not a profession that they're going to be attracted to or want to enter.
I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide. We start the program in Ravensthorpe on the southern coast of Western Australia, where a farmer has died whilst fighting a fire on Monday. The fire was one of two emergency level blazes burning out of control in the state on the first day of summer. Speaking at a press conference, WA Premier Roger Cook addressed media and the Ravensthorpe community.
This is a desperately sad situation, and our hearts go out to that gentleman and his family. It's another reminder to all Western Australians that any hot summer is a dangerous time. Please take every precaution ahead of any fire event, and please do everything you can to keep yourself safe if you're part of the firefight yourself.
WA Premier Roger Cook there. Our reporter Rosemary Murphy has been in Ravensthorpe today to meet with the community. I spoke with her earlier.
We know that it was a really large bushfire that was reported to authorities early yesterday afternoon near Ravensthorpe and in the area of West River. It was a fast-moving bushfire that was threatening several homes. And speaking to the incident controller today, he described the conditions out there yesterday as treacherous. So the man was using a front-end loader to establish a fire break. When the fire engulfed the vehicle, he sadly died at the scene. Authorities have confirmed that he is believed to be a local resident.
And is the fire now under control?
The fire is contained but not controlled. It was at an emergency level yesterday. It was downgraded to Watch and Act, and that Watch and Act alert remains in place. About 60 firefighters are still on the ground. There's also aerial support that's helping them out today.
And is there any idea on how the fire started?
So we heard from the Department of Fire and Emergency Services Commissioner Darren Clem earlier today, and he confirmed the fire started as a result of a header fire during a harvest operation. And this was during really hot, dry conditions yesterday with really strong gusty winds.
Now, you've been in Ravensthorpe today. What have you heard from the community there?
So we spoke with the local shire president, Rachel Gibson, and she spoke about how tight this local community is. It's a small town. It's a large cropping area. Lots of people are really busy at this time of year. It's harvest, and many of the first responders were local farmers, and she said that the community will be rocked by what's happened, and this is just the start of the bushfire season, and it's a sad reminder of just how dangerous that can be.
And just finally, Rosemary, how are conditions looking for the coming days?
Yeah, so it's looking a little bit more promising. The temperatures are a little bit lower than they were, and the winds have calmed quite a lot from what they were, but obviously it's still quite dangerous conditions at the moment.
That was Rosemary Murphy speaking to me earlier from Ravensthorpe on the south coast of WA.
ABC Australia Wide.
And in the time since speaking to Rosemary, the farmer has been identified as 59-year-old Mark Moody. This was confirmed to the ABC by his son, Nathan. Mr. Moody was the local town's deputy shire president and a well-respected member of the community in WA's Great Southern region. Further north in Geraldton, one home has been lost and hundreds of others were threatened by a bushfire that authorities suspect was deliberately lit. Dozens of firefighters were sent from Perth to help extinguish the bushfire in extremely hot, dry and windy conditions with a maximum temperature of 42 degrees. Our reporter Kaysen Ho spoke to Nick Morgan, who lost his home and his pet cat in the fires.
I've lost my home, all my belongings, and my cat. I've got nothing. Now I've got to start from scratch.
How did you find out what had happened?
It was confirmed by a audio channel on the television. When somebody mentioned that a house in Robin Place had gone up, they said that it had gone up because of a palm tree had caught a light, and ours is one of the only places there that had palm trees. And shortly after, the police and Shire contacted me and confirmed that that was my house.
And what was your initial reaction when you heard the news?
Shock. Dumbfounded. My partner was in shock as well. We couldn't believe it. You see stories like this happen to other people, but you don't think it's going to happen to you. And the authorities suspect it may have been deliberately lit, but they're investigating it. If it was deliberately lit, karma's looking for him. A terrible thing to light up a fire like this. You take away somebody's life. You take away their loved ones, their pets, their possessions. Was it really worth it just for thrill of seeing something burn? Are they that callous? Are they that spineless? I don't want to go down the anger path because it doesn't serve me. It doesn't bring my cat back. It doesn't bring my home back.
Have you been able to go back to your home to see what's still there?
I've seen illegal aerial footage of the wreckage, and that was heartbreaking. The authorities have said that they may be able to get me back in as a special courtesy, which I'll be very grateful for, so that I can see firsthand the damage. But no, I haven't seen it firsthand yet.
Nick Morgan there, speaking to reporter Kaysen Ho about losing his home in the Geraldton fires. And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company here on Australia Wide. The Bureau of Meteorology has again defended spending nearly $100 million on its controversial new website. The bomb has been in damage control since its redesigned website launched on the 22nd of October. The response from the public was swift, harsh, and widespread, with social media and radio talkback awash with criticism. New CEO Stuart Minchin, Environment Minister Murray Watt, and bomb staff were grilled about the overhauled site at a Senate hearing on Monday night. Justine Longmore has the story.
New bomb CEO Stuart Minchin has only been in the top job for 3 weeks, but it was mainly left to him to answer questions about the agency's new website and IT upgrade at Senate Estimates last night. The hearing was running 5 hours behind schedule, so the bomb wasn't up until 20 past 10. That gave senators only 40 minutes to grill the Bureau before the hearing concluded. Most of the questions focused on the cost of the website and the major IT upgrade called Robust that it was a part of. Dr. Minchin.
The Bureau's website has been a key focus of late, and I want to put some context around that project on the record. In 2015, the Bureau experienced a significant cyber intrusion, followed by major technology outages in 2016. The Bureau needed to completely transform its vast information and observing technology systems. The Robust program was created in response to this.
Dr. Minchin said the Robust program cost $866 million until June 2024, and a transition program to complete unfinished projects cost an additional $47 million. As he revealed last week, the website cost was 10% of that program.
The new website accounted for approximately $96 million of the overall cost of the Robust program. This cost reflects a significant investment required to fully rebuild all the layers of technology and system that underpins the website. We needed to make sure it is secure and stable and can draw in the huge amounts of data gathered from our observing network and weather models as we handle millions of visits each day.
He acknowledged the website didn't meet the expectations of the Australian public.
The response to the launch of the new bomb website shows that we didn't get it right for some sectors of the community. We accept this feedback, and I have personally seen firsthand just how committed the Bureau staff are to understanding and addressing this feedback.
Victorian Liberal Senator Sarah Henderson asked how $96 million could be spent on a website that she's described as a dog's breakfast.
It's very simple to say it's a website. The website is what people see, but underpinning that is a whole technology stack that goes from 10,000 instruments in the field that are feeding that data through into ultimately one of our supercomputers. It's being fed through multiple models. It then gets spat out into operational systems. Our meteorologists pull those models together and create the forecasting itself that then makes it into the website.
The robust program has been examined during previous Senate hearings, and South Australian Greens Senator Barbara Pocock didn't hold back last night.
Really, more broadly, I feel this project has been a really, you know, nightmare Harvard case study in contract failure and management of contracts, failure of leadership, and completely unacceptable and unethical behaviour by the very big consultants who have been at the trough.
Dr. Minchin said the program has been reviewed several times.
The program, the robust program as a whole, though, has undergone multiple external reviews by the Department of Finance. 8 gateway reviews have been undertaken by the Department of Finance. The most recent one finished last week. And the program received a green light from that external review, the gateway review. It's also been subject to multiple digital transformation agency assurance reviews throughout the programs.
Environment Minister Murray Watt has committed to learning from this.
This may well be a contract that demonstrates the need for greater oversight and of consultants.
Dr. Minchin said they're taking the feedback about the website on board and changes are being made.
There are no doubts that, as I said in my opening statement, the website itself and the front end has not met all user needs in the community, and there are active programs underway to improve and act on that feedback. So I think it's reasonable for the Australian public to ask us what's going on.
That's the CEO of the Bureau of Meteorology, Stuart Minchin, ending that report from Justine Longmore. Teacher shortages are being felt right across Australia, but particularly in regional and remote areas of Queensland. Education researchers estimate up to 50% of graduate teachers leave the profession within their first 5 years on the job. It's not just the state system that's in trouble. Independent and Catholic schools are feeling the pinch and are trialling programs at relieving the workload for early career teachers in the hopes that will help them stay in the classroom. Mark Rigby reports.
Year 6. I need
in this Gold Coast classroom, former Royal Australian Air Force instructor Chris Holt uses skills learned in the military to teach his students. But even for someone with his life experience, the demands of being an early career teacher are starting to mount.
The stresses and pressures of the profession feel like they're growing at a rate, and I'm experiencing that even only after being in for a couple of years.
Chris Holt is not alone. Australian researchers estimate up to 50% of graduate teachers leave the profession within their first 5 years on the job, citing burnout and increased workload. It's bad news for an education sector already struggling with workforce shortages, but some schools are looking for solutions. At All Saints Anglican School, where Mr. Holt teaches, Principal Matt Corbett this year launched an additional teacher program aimed at reducing staff workload.
If not already, we're nearing a crisis. We need to make the profession particularly attractive for young people. And if they hear or read the statistics that we know full too well, of the volume of hours that teachers are working outside of the workplace, and that's affecting their well-being and work-life balance, which is so important for young people today, it's not a profession that they're going to be attracted to or want to enter.
By redirecting resources but without employing any extra staff, the program assigns experienced teachers to several classrooms across a year level. They then help plan and deliver lessons across multiple classrooms.
We want our teachers diverting their energy to our young people rather than administration.
Helping guide Mr. Holt and his Year 6 teaching colleagues is Joanna Smith, who's been teaching for more than 15 years.
It's not someone just helping you, so I lead some lessons, the Year 6 teachers will lead some lessons, and then we support each other. So it's like a team teaching model.
Mr. Holt says he and his students are reaping the benefits of the program.
As an early career teacher, having access to an additional teacher to take away some of that workload, some of that stress, has just been golden. Having two teachers in the room, no student can slip through the cracks.
Matt Corbett concedes his independent, fee-paying school is in a privileged position and having an additional teacher per year level isn't feasible everywhere. But he says the early results of the program are promising.
If there's a shared responsibility for the planning, for the teaching and reflecting on the learning in the class, naturally that's going to enhance the energy and focus of our teachers. So the well-being of our teachers reportedly has gone up.
Education researcher Glenys Oberg studies the impact of increased workload on teachers and how it contributes to burnout and teacher attrition rates.
We've got a huge number of teachers Australia-wide who are leaving the profession. It's almost like a vicious cycle. Attrition leads to more workload, which leads to more attrition. So it's this cycle at the moment and it doesn't seem to be stopping. We know from the research that mentoring is a huge benefit both for the mentors and the mentees. Teaching can be a really isolating position, especially with all of the extra admin and data collection that teachers are asked to do. It's not a place to get that camaraderie. So anything that you can do in a school to really build that systemic support will be hugely beneficial. So mentoring is a great start.
In the state's far north, the Catholic Education Diocese of Cairns has also taken measures into its own hands. It started awarding full university scholarships to aspiring teachers, with recipients committing to at least 2 years full-time work within the diocese schools after they graduate. It's an expensive solution, costing more than $200,000 since the program began in 2022. But the diocese executive director, Dermot O'Riordan, says it's a necessary investment.
The secret is getting quality teachers, getting teachers that really want to be there, that have a commitment to the profession, see it as something more than just a job, it's more like a vocation. It absolutely is making a difference for us, partly because they feel that they've been supported, they're mentored, they've already got some connections and relationships with schools here in our diocese, and that adds to, you know, them coming into our schools and adding the quality or being that quality teacher that we're seeking.
Can anyone tell me what we have learnt in Animal Farm so far?
21-year-old Olivia Parisi is among the first group of bachelor's scholarship recipients and will next year take the reins of her own high school class. For the past 2 years, she's also been working as a teacher's assistant at MacKillop Catholic College, south of Cairns.
It's always been more than just a job to me. I feel like it's a commitment to inspiring others, watching people grow.
She says the scholarship, the on-the-job experience and the university placements she's completed have prepared her for the reality of being a teacher, but admits even before leading her own classroom, she's already doing a lot of work outside school hours.
Yes, I like to be prepared, and obviously being a graduate teacher, it's also about learning all of the content as well before you're able to teach it. I've really been fortunate enough to have a network of people that I can go to with all my endless questions and my doubts that help guide me.
That's soon-to-be qualified teacher Olivia Parisi, ending that report from Mark Rigby. A local newspaper in outback New South Wales that ceased publication nearly 18 months ago has begun emptying the contents of the more than 100-year-old building that it's occupied. But there are concerns that one of the biggest items yet to go on the market, the paper's still functioning printing press, may be more valuable as scrap metal. Broken Hill reporter Oliver Brown has more.
As the final pages of the last edition of Broken Hill's Barrier Truth newspaper were printed in mid-April 2024, it signalled the end of an era in more ways than one. Operating for more than 125 years, the paper, once known as the Barrier Daily Truth, was the city's longest ongoing news provider, printing more than 33,000 daily and later weekly editions. Broken Hill local Emily McInerney was one of many journalists to call the publication home, who retains fond memories of working there over the span of a decade.
It had so much history and there were so many parts to it that you always enjoyed exploring. You know, the upstairs, which used to be the former editorial, the old print section, just even being able to see the printing presses was amazing. You were watching history in action when you worked there.
But the contents of this historic building are now in the process of being sold or removed entirely. It's part of efforts by the paper's former operators, the Barrier Industrial Council, to pay off old debts, which played a significant role in its closure.
When we stopped printing, there was that period of time where we had hoped that we would be able to continue or restart the local newspaper. Unfortunately, that time has passed. Obviously, we were already looking at our creditors and our debtors, trying to wind up that part of the business. So it was decided that we would empty the building as much as possible.
That's Rosalind Ferry, the president of the BIC and chair of the Barrier Truth Board, who says she was heartbroken to ultimately close the Truth after it survived the COVID-19 pandemic only a few years prior. She says some items have been relatively easy to sell, including surplus furniture and office supplies, while others only have pure historical value.
Certainly the bound copies of the Barrier Daily Truth. We have the publications going back to the first issue. They're in varying degrees of fragility. So we certainly be looking to have an entire collection. We don't want to split that collection. And probably the obvious place for housing that collection would be the Trades Hall. So that's our aim at this point.
But one item still has an uncertain future. The decades-old printing press, which former general manager Gavin Schmidt worries may have issues finding a buyer.
I don't really believe printing presses are worth anything now. Even as far back as 10 years ago, we used to get our press service by a Melbourne company who covered all of New South Wales and Victoria. And the guy was talking to me and he just said, look, mate, he said, there's a lot of buildings now with presses in and people have had to close down and they've just shut the doors and walked out. Presses are worth nothing because there's so many of them sitting in deserted buildings in Melbourne, Sydney and all around the country region. And he said, the only thing they're worth now is their scrap metal. Like I said, that was nearly 10 years ago and it's even worse now.
Mildura-based newspaper publishers, the Lanyon family, recently encountered this trend firsthand after selling their newspaper interests to an interstate media company earlier this year. Ross Lanyon confirmed to the ABC they had to recently dismantle their old print press, some of it sold as spare parts and a portion as scrap due to no global demand. At the time, their press was printing several mastheads, including Mildura's Sun Ratio Daily and even the Broken Hill Times, which the Lanyons only established last year after the Barrier Truth shut down. The limited second-hand market for non-modern printing presses doesn't come as a surprise to President of Country Press New South Wales and fourth-generation newsman Edward Higgins.
There might have been a few smaller presses that have closed down in country areas where a publisher might have bought a paper and they've already got a press or a press relationship and they've closed down that press. The investment that you have to put in to have a press is significant and staffing is also a major challenge. So most people do outsource their printing and yeah, that's sort of been a trend for many years.
Back in Broken Hill, Miss Ferry says she's aware of the challenges faced with selling the press, but is yet to commit to dooming it for the scrap heap. While she says her time with the Barrier Truth is done, she believes its rich history in Australia's first heritage city deserves to be preserved, and some of its notable memorabilia could be part of that.
The presses still work. They're just totally immovable at this point, so it would be great if someone wanted to jump in and say, well, let's use this part of the building as a museum, even a working museum. All those sort of decisions will be totally up to a combined decision by the affiliated unions. Probably nothing's going to be happening in the next year or two, but we'll see how we go. We're forever hopeful.
Barrier Truth Board Chair Rosalind Ferry finishing that report from Broken Hill reporter Oliver Brown. And finally, here on Australia Wide, we head to South Australia's Eyre Peninsula, where efforts to restore numbers of the critically endangered drooping she-oak are ongoing. And while 20 years of dedicated action has seen good results, there's now a problem. There's nowhere near enough native seeds to go around to get the job done. It's a common theme with native plants across the country, and it threatens some of Australia's global environmental commitments. Reporter Tim McGlone has the story.
Have you heard of the 30 by 30 goal? Don't worry, you're not the only one. Australia has committed to the Global Biodiversity Framework, a United Nations agreement aiming to halt and reverse biodiversity loss, with a number of goals to be reached by 2030.
Probably the most relevant one when it comes to thinking about restoring ecosystems is Target 2, getting large areas of land across the world into effective restoration. And it's often kind of called the 30 by 30 target. So 30% of the land surface area in effective restoration by 2030.
That's Rachel Gallagher, Professor of Plant Ecology and Conservation at Hawkesbury Institute for the Environment at Western Sydney University. Almost the entire world is in on this, with over 190 countries aiming to do the same thing. You might be wondering, what exactly do we mean by native land restoration?
So you can picture a site where maybe there's been a mine or something, and the mine's under a bond or a covenant that says that it needs to be restored after the mine finishes. So you've got kind of scorched earth, and you've got to go from that back to the bush. There's a lot of steps in between.
To restore degraded ecosystems with native plants, you need native seeds. And that's where the problem is.
The amount of seed that we have is just not really enough. So native species seed is what I'm talking about here. Got a lot of plant species in Australia, and not all of them, in fact, a very small proportion of them, are able to be bought off the shelf.
When Professor Gallagher says a very small amount, she's referring to the fact that just 12% of native plants in Australia can currently be bought as seed.
I'd say it's the major barrier to effective restoration and offsetting in Australia.
In a statement, the Department of Climate Change, Energy, the Environment and Water acknowledged the lack of seeds is a significant challenge for ecosystem restoration. However, they said the lack of native seed supply is not a major barrier to achieving the protection and conservation of 30% of Australia's landmass. A $5 million strategy to increase native seed supply has been finalised, but no action has been taken to implement the strategy. Drooping she-oaks are an example of the vegetation Australia is trying to restore. The trees have been on the Eyre Peninsula for thousands of years. It's found throughout southeastern Australia, stretching as far as the west of the Eyre Peninsula. The trees hold cultural significance for some Indigenous communities, while others use the timber for boomerangs. But there's a problem. Since European settlement, drooping she-oaks have been decimated by a variety of threats, grazed by domestic stock, cleared for cropping, and impacted by boom-bust cycles of kangaroos.
There's very little of its original remnants left out there in the wild, so it's down below about 2% of what it originally would have been, and it was really widespread.
Simon Bay is the project manager for the Eyre Peninsula for Greening Australia. He's at the front line of restoring native vegetation on the Eyre Peninsula.
When we're doing the restoration, we're not running around out there planting lots of millions of little trees, because that would just be too hard in this landscape, and a technique called direct seeding. So that technique is a really good way of getting this done at a big scale, but it also means there's a far greater demand on seed.
Simon says that while seed supply is an issue, the work he and Greening Australia have done over decades in working with local landowners on the issue has had a major impact, and he's optimistic about the drooping she-oak's future on the Eyre Peninsula.
Yeah, those challenges are still there, finding those seed sources. So I guess the way we're really addressing that is through several methods. So we're trying to now be a little bit more discriminant and plan really well our sites so we're not wasting any seed. We're very fortunate here to have revegetation sites and, you know, landowners. You know, if we do the right thing by them, they'll let us back on their properties to, you know, source seed from those areas.
He says many stand to benefit from the restoration of this vegetation.
Ecosystem and landowners, of course. I think there's a really big thing there. I mean, the reason that they're so engaged, the guys who want to redo this, is because they see the benefits to stock as well. So obviously there's some really big benefits to having, you know, cooler temperatures across the site. So, but from a natural point of view, we were really targeting those woodland birds that disappeared because there was no trees left for them. There was completely nothing left. So there's many species that depended on that overstory. All those smaller animals and rarer ones that come across, even the goannas, and obviously those larger animals of the wedge-toed eagles and kites and all those other things, that they need areas as well. They need trees too. So huge benefit to, you know, land production and to nature conservation, without a doubt.
While the chances of replenishing the drooping she-oak on the Eyre Peninsula look promising, Professor Gallagher is worried about native restoration across the country, especially for plants that aren't listed as critically endangered.
There's many, many plant species in Australia that are not even being assessed for their extinction risk, unfortunately. And so that means that we are in a bit of a situation where we could have lots of species which are trending toward decline across their range. What's the consequences if we don't get this right? Well, I guess the consequences are that we just endlessly treat native vegetation like it's a resource that will just always be there, and you just keep kind of chipping away at it and taking a bit more and a bit more and not putting it back in a high quality way. We'll end up transforming the vegetation that we have in Australia, you know, pretty far beyond what it was.
That story from Tim McGlone from South Australia's Eyre Peninsula. And that is Australia Wide for this Tuesday. I'm Alex Simon. Thanks so much for your company. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.